Welcome to the deep dive. Okay, let's step away from the constant news updates for a bit today.
Yeah, let's dig into something with a bit more perspective.
Exactly. We're looking at A Bowl for All Seasons. It's basically a collection of writings from Dr. Bob Frilich, a Wall Street strategist.
Right, covering about a decade's worth of his thinking, put together in his 2009 book.
And he was writing, importantly, for a Main Street audience, not just Wall Street insiders. So our mission today...
Well, it's to see what timeless advice we can pull out, right? And how his takes back then kind of connect with what we're seeing now.
Okay, let's get into it. The source itself, this book. He really makes a point of his background, doesn't he?
He does. He emphasizes, you know, his Main Street roots. He wants to teach and inform, not just preach about markets.
And these commentaries were written in real time, basically.
Yeah.
Like on his BlackBerry.
Yeah. Handwritten notes, BlackBerry messages. It's his immediate analysis as things were happening. The dot-com bubble bursting, early signs of the housing issues.
So it's a real snapshot. And he structured the book around themes.
Mm-hmm. The economy, the Fed, markets, global stuff. Makes it pretty easy to follow his thinking.
All right, let's start with the big one, the economy. He kicks off with a nice, simple definition of interest. What was it?
He calls it paying rent on money. Simple, right?
Huh, yeah, like that. And he touches on some Keynesian ideas, too.
Yep, induced and autonomous consumption, and that key one, the marginal propensity to consume. You know, how much of an extra dollar someone is likely to spend.
Basic stuff, but fundamental.
Absolutely fundamental. And for you, the listener, understanding that how much people spend versus save, how borrowing costs bite, it's crucial context for any economic news, really.
Still relevant today with all the talk about consumer spending and rate hikes.
Totally. It always comes back to these basics.
He also spends time on inflation measures. CPI, PPI.
Yeah, all the acronyms. COL, GDP deflator. He makes the point that inflation is always on Wall Street's mind.
But here's the interesting bit. Even back then, when some people worried about inflation.
His own economist was actually leaning towards deflationary pressures.
Why was that?
Well, mainly because of the global economy becoming more connected and rising productivity. He even notes Greenspan, the Fed chair then, kind of acknowledging this shift.
Wow. So the narrative wasn't straightforward even then.
Not at all. It's a great reminder for you, listening now. How often does the main story maybe hide these quieter underlying shifts?
Good point. His focus on globalization and productivity pushing down on prices was pretty ahead of its time, wasn't it?
It really was. Shows how interconnected things were becoming, even then. Tells us you always got to look beyond your own borders for inflation risks.
Okay, another core theme for him. Earnings. Company profits.
Right. He argues that's the real engine. Everything else, political scandals, global crises.
Monica Gate, the Russian crisis he mentions.
Yeah, that's mostly short-term noise, in his view. It creates volatility, sure. But earnings are what drives the market long term.
And expectations matter hugely, right? Like how the market thinks earnings will be.
Oh, massively. He talks about how sometimes results that are just not as bad as expected can actually give the market a lift.
So the key takeaway for you is distinguishing between those fundamental value drivers, like profits, and the temporary bumps from news events.
Exactly. News grabs headlines, makes markets jumpy short term, but long haul. Profitability is key.
He also talks about tax refunds, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, how they impact the economy. Mm. He noted some surprisingly large refunds one year because of like the child tax credit and education credits.
And the shift to electronic transfers made a difference?
Big difference. Money got into people's hands and potentially the economy way faster.
So it shows how fiscal policy, governed decisions, can have a pretty direct, quick impact.
Definitely. It highlights paying attention to the plumbing of the economy, how money actually moves around.
He also lays out reasons why the U.S. economy often slowed down in the second half of the year. What were those?
A few things. Those tax refunds drying up.
Yeah.
Earlier interest rate hikes starting to bite.
He mentioned the 30-year Treasury yield as a sign of higher rates then.
Right. Plus, mortgage refinancing slowing down and rising oil prices having that, you know, psychological hit.
It's almost like a checklist of potential headwinds you might see.
Pretty much. It gives you a framework for thinking about these sort of cyclical patterns in growth. Helps anticipate shifts.
Okay. Back to inflation for a sec.
Yeah.
He warned against focusing only on gold, right?
Yeah, that's a great point. He said, look at the broader CRB commodity index instead. Tracks lots of raw materials.
So even if gold and oil were up, the wider index might not show inflation.
Exactly. At the time he was writing about, that was the case. Gold and oil were rising, but the CRB wasn't screaming inflation.
He mentions the Y2K gold bug phenomenon, too.
Yeah. People hoarding gold because they thought computers crashing would end the world, basically.
So the lesson for you is don't get tunnel vision on one indicator.
Absolutely. That CRB index gives a much fuller picture of price pressures, NY2K, a reminder of how fear can spike specific assets.
What about the new economy and the internet? His take was pretty grounded.
Surprisingly so, yeah. He saw the internet mainly as a tool. He thought the big winners could be old economy companies that just use the tech well.
Like Southwest Airlines, he mentioned.
Perfect example. Using the internet to be more efficient, connect with customers better, cuts through the dot-com hype.
So for you listening, innovation isn't just about startups. It's established players adapting too.
Precisely. Smart adaptation.
He also had this idea of an invisible workforce. What was that?
People not officially unemployed, but who could work. Maybe discouraged workers, people taking time out.
And his point was this could keep wages from rising too fast, even with low unemployment.
Yeah, potentially. It dampens wage inflation because there's this reserve pool of labor. His point was how we measure these numbers really matters.
It's a more nuanced look at the labor market than just the headline rate.
Definitely. Challenges that simple link between low unemployment and soaring wages.
Okay, shifting to government. Budget deficits, spending. How did he approach that?
Context. He stressed looking at the deficit as a percentage of GDP, the whole economy.
Right, not just the big raw number.
Exactly. And comparing it historically, or to, say, the criteria the European Monetary Union used, gives you scale.
That makes sense. Is a $1 billion deficit big? Depends on the size of the economy.
Totally. Context is everything there.
I liked his analogy of blizzards versus icebergs for the market.
Yeah, that's a good one. Blizzards are the short-term panics, the noise.
And icebergs.
Those are the big, slow-moving, long-term drivers. Things like budget surpluses back then or major tech shifts. Those are the things that really shape long-term returns.
Powerful way for you to think about filtering news, right?
Yeah.
Focus on the icebergs.
Absolutely. Look past the daily flurries.
He also talked about the jobless recovery after the dot-com bust.
He thought Y2K factors played a part. Companies maybe overhired for that, then let people go. And he suspected the initial government job numbers were undercounting creation.
He even cited a Wall Street Journal piece suggesting outsourcing could create U.S. jobs. That might surprise people.
Yeah, it's a complex argument about efficiency gains and new roles being created. Offers a different perspective on globalization's impact.
There's a specific point about dividends, too, after that 2003 Tax Act.
Right, the Jobs and Growth Tax Relief Reconciliation Act. He clarified companies could still pay high dividends, just highlighting how policy changes directly affect investors.
Made those dividend stocks more attractive then.
For sure, lower tax rate helps.
He also touched on hurricanes. The immediate hit, then the rebuilding boom.
Yeah, a grim reminder of the economic cycle of natural disasters. Short-term pain, often followed by a surge in activity for rebuilding.
Finally, on the economy section, he mentions the January effect.
Ah, yes, the old Wall Street saying, as January goes, so goes the year.
Market folklore, mostly.
Pretty much. Fun to track, maybe, but its predictive power is highly debatable.
Okay, let's move to the Federal Reserve Board. The Fed. He lays out its basic job pretty clearly.
Yeah, managing monetary policy, influencing money supply, credit costs, all aimed at national economic goals, and how they do it by targeting that key interest rate, the federal funds rate, using open market operations.
It's a good quick summary of what the Fed does.
And for you, understanding the Fed's mandate and tools is just vital. Their decisions hit your mortgage rate, inflation, the whole economy's pace.
He describes a period in 98 as, what was it, irrational trepidation.
That's the phrase, market anxiety driven by a mix of things.
Like,
Well, global stuff, military uncertainty. He specifically mentions the Monica Lewinsky scandal, Boris Yeltsin's troubles in Russia, questions about U.S. military action.
so investors got nervous and ran to cash.
Pretty much. Shows how non-economic factors, politics, geopolitics can really sway market mood.
Market psychology is powerful.
Hugely powerful.
He also reflects on the Dow hitting 10,000 seeming impossible back then.
Right, but then he immediately pivots to anything is possible. He references Mark McGwire hitting all those home runs and Greenspan's irrational trepidation phrase again.
Captures that market unpredictability. You just don't know.
Exactly. Don't set rigid limits on what the market might do. Surprises happen.
He explains the Humphrey Hawkins Act. why the Fed chair's testimony to Congress is such a big deal globally.
Yeah, it's about transparency, accountability. The Fed explaining its view of the economy and its strategy to lawmakers and really the world. Everyone watches it.
A key moment for understanding the Fed's thinking.
Definitely. And potential policy shifts.
He also flags the creation of the euro, the EMU, anticipating impacts on global competition.
Yeah. Shows he was thinking globally. The euro was massive, obviously. Changed trade, investment, currencies. His early take on the competitive impact was smart.
And he notes that because global growth was mixed then, with issues in Japan, Argentina, Germany,
the Fed couldn't just focus inward anymore. It had to consider global issues, really setting the stage for today's interconnected world.
Central banks don't operate in a vacuum.
Not anymore. He even mentioned a period where tons of central banks cut rates globally in a short time. Coordinated, almost.
Interesting point about wages. He argued M&A, mergers, might affect wages more than just low unemployment.
Yeah, a bit counterintuitive. His thinking was that job security fears in merging companies might actually hold wages down, even if the job market looked tight overall.
So, corporate restructuring impacting pay, more than just supply and demand for labor.
That was his argument. Peace. Highlights how corporate strategy filters down.
He tells a story about yackers from the Treasury causing market jitters.
Ha, huh, yeah. An undersecretary apparently misspoke about the 30-year bond caused some volatility. Shows how crucial careful communication from officials is.
Loose lips sink ships, or at least wobble markets.
Something like that. Clarity and consistency are vital.
Then he talks hackers, internet security concerns back then.
Right, but his view was kind of laissez-faire. He thought the tech industry itself would solve it without needing government stepping in.
Faith in the private sector to self-regulate on tech issues.
Yeah, reflects that ongoing debate. Regulation versus industry solutions.
He notes the Fed hiking rates in the late 90s, early 2000s, and saw cuts coming.
Mm-hmm. He anticipated that turn in the cycle. Shows the importance of tracking the Fed's signals.
He even coined a nickname for Ben Bernanke.
Hurricane Ben, yeah. Mm-hmm. Expressed some worry about Bernanke's weight tightening, especially regarding rent inflation.
Colorful. Shows his viewpoint clearly.
Definitely conveys a strong take on that policy direction.
And lastly, on the Fed, he used a specific jobs report, July of 1 year, to argue the Fed should stop hiking rates.
Right, pointing to slower job growth, higher unemployment rate, weak household numbers. Shows how specific data points feed directly into those huge Fed decisions.
Exactly. Jobs data is always a massive piece of the Fed's puzzle.
Okay, let's shift to the markets themselves. He starts with the basics. The purpose of stock exchanges.
Yeah, places like the NYSE, your virtual ones.
Yeah.
Facilitating trading, price discovery, matching buyers and sellers. He even mentions the specialists on the NYSE floor.
Just the mechanics of how it works.
Essential background for understanding the system. And he stresses how stock prices affect the real economy, right? And public mood.
Definitely. Rising stocks can make businesses invest more, make households feel richer, and spend more, the wealth effect. That's why central banks watch the market so closely.
It connects the financial world to the real world.
Absolutely. They're intertwined.
He mentions Sears having disappointing pre-earnings news once, even when the economy was strong. How did he read that?
Interestingly, he saw it maybe as a sign that profits could be even stronger than expected later because of momentum from earlier rate cuts. A contrarian take.
Looking past the immediate bad news for underlying strength.
Yeah. Seeing the bigger picture. Strong growth. Lower borrowing costs that can outweigh temporary issues.
He explains the big market indices clearly. Dow, S&P 500, Russell 2000.
Right, highlighting the differences. Dow's 30 stocks, S&P's broader but still selective, Russell's objective small cap focus. Understanding these helps you interpret the market's performance.
Knowing what each index actually represents.
Crucial for an informed view.
He talks about the new dawn of the internet, citing that stat about internet access overtaking newspaper delivery.
Yeah, around 2002, a really powerful marker of that huge societal shift, how we got information, did business, everything changing.
There's a quick kind of random mention of turning 21 being significant.
Huh, yeah. Sometimes these commentaries have little personal asides, maybe just a relatable moment or a breather.
And a much stronger point about corporate accountability.
Oh, yeah. He even jokes about a TV show road trip to interview jailed CEOs. Reflects that post-Enron, post-WorldCom demand for ethical leadership.
Holding companies responsible.
Big theme back then. and still relevant.
He talks about whales in the market. What are those?
Large, supposedly informed investors. The idea is their activity, especially buying after a downturn, might signal a bottom, smart money moving in.
So watching what the big players do.
Some strategies focus on that, yeah. Tracking institutional flows.
He discusses a big wave of M&A, mergers and acquisitions.
Yep, especially in oil, but also consumer goods, telecom, financials. A huge consolidation trend changing the competitive landscape.
Reshaping whole industries.
Definitely. Companies trying to grow, get more efficient, gain an edge.
And he connected a strengthening U.S. dollar to certain sectors.
Right. Telecom and financials, which had less foreign sales, might benefit relatively. A stronger dollar makes overseas profits worth less when brought home.
Interesting link between currency moves and sector performance.
Shows how interconnected these things are.
He also saw a shift where large companies started outperforming smaller ones again.
Yeah, the pendulum swinging. Small caps had done well, but then large caps, after hoarding cash post-Sarbanes-Oxley, started spending it on M&A.
So the drivers of performance were changing.
Happens all the time. Different market phases favor different types of stocks.
He noted a ton of retail cash sitting on the sidelines. Thought it could fuel large caps.
He did. Billions, maybe trillions. He thought it could push large caps higher, though he admits later that prediction didn't quite play out.
Good that he acknowledges that. Forecasting is tough.
Very tough. Shows honesty.
His advice then was, forget the indicators, focus on basics.
Pretty much. Consumer spending, business spending, earnings. Back to fundamentals.
That's the core stuff that drives things long-term.
That's his argument. Provides a more solid base than chasing short-term signals.
He saw the financial sector hitting highs as a positive sign, linked to the Fed potentially pausing rate hikes.
Right. Financials are very sensitive to interest rate expectations. So if the market thinks rates will stabilize, banks and financials often do well, which can lift the whole market.
And he flagged international markets outperforming the U.S.
Yeah, that was a big theme in the mid-2000s. Really drove home the importance of looking beyond U.S. borders for investment opportunities.
Global diversification.
Became much more mainstream thinking around then.
He describes crazy markets reacting weirdly to news.
Yeah, like the Fed pauses hikes and the market drops. Or bad news hits and it rallies. Shows that disconnect sometimes between headlines and immediate market moves.
Short-term reactions can seem irrational.
Driven by sentiment, technicals, immediate interpretations, not always pure fundamentals. Hard to predict those swings.
He lists some huge gains in global markets.
Yeah.
China, Brazil, others, again, pushing that global investing idea.
Just reinforcing the point with data. Different parts of the world were growing much faster at times.
He mentions the Dow hitting 12,000, but downplays the number itself.
Yeah, saying percentage gains are more meaningful. 1,000 points isn't the same percentage gain when the index is higher. Keep it relative.
Good point about perspective.
Always look at percentages for performance.
He explains buy and hold pretty clearly.
The classic long-term strategy based on markets historically going up over time and how hard it is to successfully time the ups and downs. He links it to the efficient market hypothesis, the idea you can't consistently beat the market.
So just stay invested for a long haul.
That's the core idea. Avoid churning.
He discusses the long-term capital management LTCM bailout. That was a big deal.
It's huge. Hedge fund run by supposedly brilliant minds, including Nobel winners, took on way too much leverage, made bad bets, and almost blew up the system.
Raised worries about other hedge funds, right?
Definitely. A real wake-up call about hidden risks and leverage in the system.
He lists factors needed for a market rebound at one point. IMF approval, Japanese bank reform.
Shows how international policy and events were seen as key drivers for market recovery then.
Global factors influencing U.S. markets.
Increasingly so.
He uses that great example of compounding. The dollar doubling every day for a month.
Yeah, shows the power of it vividly. How money-earning returns on its returns leads to exponential growth over time. A core concept for you as a long-term investor.
Really drives home the benefit of starting early and staying invested.
Absolutely. Time is your friend with compounding.
He flags three concerns at one point.
Okay.
Oil prices, a market correction, rising interest rates.
Classic headwinds for stocks and the economy. Things investors often worry about.
There's a funny bit about the laptop indicator replacing the Greenspan briefcase indicator.
Yeah. Huh? Just a lighthearted comment on changing times and symbols of influence. Who carries the important info now?
He saw positive tax reform in Germany, potentially boosting Europe and beyond.
Yeah, highlighting how policy in one major economy can ripple outwards, affecting growth and M&A elsewhere.
Interconnectedness again.
Constant theme.
He laments a decline in U.S. corporate governance standards. First to worst.
Strong words. Reflects the reaction to scandals and the push for more accountability and ethical behavior from companies.
Governance matters for investor trust.
Absolutely crucial.
He sees the U.S. dollar coming back to reality after being overvalued.
Currencies fluctuate. Periods of being too high or too low often correct over time based on fundamentals.
And again, emphasizes fundamentals becoming important monetary policy, economic growth, as bullish for stocks.
Back to basics. When the Fed's accommodative, or at least not tightening, and the economy's growing, that's usually good for stocks long term.
He suggests hitting the mute button on company guidance sometimes.
Yeah, his point was that companies might report strong current earnings, but then give super cautious outlooks. He's saying maybe focus more on the actual results achieved.
Don't get too spooked by conservative forecasts if the present looks good.
Kind of. Or at least weigh them carefully.
He liked that big companies like Coke and McDonald's were stopping quarterly earnings forecasts.
Yeah, saw it as positive, focusing on running the business, sales, operations, instead of just managing expectations to beat the street every 3 months.
That beat the street pressure can be dangerous, he implies, referencing Enron, WorldCom.
Exactly. Can lead to short-term thinking, even fraud. A focus on sustainable long-term performance is healthier.
He uses the good, the bad, and the ugly to summarize the market picture once.
Nice framing device. Ugly. Iraq war, oil prices, bad. Governance issues, pension costs, good.
Mm-hmm.
Supportive monetary fiscal policy, decent profits, helps categorize the forces at play.
Gives you a quick snapshot of the key influences.
Mm-hmm.
He pushes back against the idea that consumers were buried in debt or their net worth crushed by the bear market.
Yeah. Defending the consumer's importance. Consumer spending is such a huge part of the economy, so their health is critical.
Don't count the consumer out too easily.
That seems to be his message there.
Then there's the Daytona 500 indicator.
Yeah.
Seriously.
Yeah, linking the winning cars make to the Dow's performance. Pure market folklore. Fun, but not investment advice.
Correlation, not causation, at best.
If even that. Just a fun anecdote.
He flags stocks and bonds rallying together as a positive sign.
Right. Often called a Goldilocks signal. Suggests the market expects growth to continue without runaway inflation, meaning interest rates might stay stable or fall, which is good for both stocks and bonds.
A sweet spot for the economy.
That's the idea.
He noted a shift in market leadership from narrow tech focus in 2000 to broader participation later.
Yeah, across healthcare, tech, consumer sectors, he saw that broader leadership as healthier, more sustainable, not just one or two sectors carrying the market.
A sign of a more balanced recovery.
Generally considered so, yes.
He picked financials as a key theme for 2004, even with expected rate hikes. Why?
He cited the level of rates, strong earnings, and wealth factors still being supportive for them. A specific sector call based on multiple factors.
Shows how you build an investment case for a sector.
Exactly. Analyzing the specific drivers.
He acknowledged drags on the consumer, weak wages, high oil, but saw offsets.
Mm-hmm. Low interest rates, recovering stock prices, boosting wealth, rising home prices back then, productivity gains. It's always a balance of forces.
Never just one thing driving consumer behavior.
Right. Need to weigh the positives and negatives.
He listed 7 reasons for optimism at one point, just painting a positive picture.
Yeah, laying out the bull case clearly. Low rates, good housing market then, productivity, etc.
And that is his playful 5th T, 12, for Dow 12,000 predicting it between Thanksgiving and Tax Day.
Huh. Memorable, if specific. A bit of showmanship in the forecast.
He talks about how companies use cash. Return it to shareholders or reinvest it. Both mm-hmm. good.
In his view, yes. Dividends and buybacks directly reward shareholders. Reinvesting in hiring, equipment, R&D fuels future growth, both seen as bullish uses of strong cash flow.
Positive feedback loop from profits.
Exactly.
And finally, on markets, 5 reasons for being bullish at one point. Low rates, falling oil, like a tax cut, housing scare easing, global capital spending boom.
Just summarizing the key positive factors converging at that time, a strong confluence creating a favorable setup.
Okay, let's pivot to policy and politics. He starts with definitions, then the Wall Street view of left versus right.
Yeah, just setting the stage. How government actions and political leanings are viewed through a market lens.
He talks about Mexico needing tax reform back then.
All right. Too reliant on oil taxes.
Yeah.
Pension President Fox's plans to broaden the base shows awareness of fiscal issues beyond the U.S.
Global policy matters.
Increasing.
He predicted U.S. tax reforms focused on saving and investment.
Yeah, things like bigger IRAs, better 401ks, lower capital gains tax, business tax cuts. Policy ideas aimed directly at boosting markets and investment.
Using the tax code to encourage certain economic behaviors.
Common policy tool.
His take on the California electricity crisis.
Saw it as a botched implementation of deregulation in California, not a failure of deregulation itself. Still believed in the long-term benefits if done right.
A nuanced view on a complex issue.
Yeah, separating the principle from a specific flawed execution.
He called Bush's tax cut package, "It's the stock market, stupid."
Pretty direct framing, saying its main goal was boosting the market. He identified taxpayers, retail via child tax credit, and tech via expensing as winners.
Assessing the intended economic impact.
Right. Who benefits from specific policy choices?
He used anecdotal evidence, like Broadway sales, to gauge the economy.
Yeah, sometimes those little real-world observations can offer hints about consumer mood or activity levels. Complementing the big data.
Boots on the ground feel.
Can be useful, yeah.
He weighed political outcomes for an election based on jobs and Iraq.
Standard political analysis, thinking about how key issues might influence voters and potentially shift policy direction. Market participants always watch elections closely.
Policy impacts markets.
That's the chain. Yeah.
For the drug sector, he thought market fundamentals mattered more than political risk.
Specifically, pricing power shifting to big buyers. He argued those business realities were more important than potential political interference, prioritizing market forces.
Interesting sector-specific take.
Yeah, depends on the industry.
He saw a Japanese election as crucial for global markets, potentially driving reform there.
Again, highlighting global interconnectedness. What happens politically in a major economy like Japan matters everywhere.
Echoes that Fed point earlier.
Exactly. No longer operating in isolation.
He discussed a potential 0% dividend tax rate if Bush won re-election.
Specific policy outcome with direct implications for dividend stocks and investors holding them.
Tax policy matters for investment strategy.
Hugely.
He pointed to stable oil prices as a key positive heading into 2005.
Yeah, lower or stable energy costs are generally a big plus for the economy. Like a tax cut, as he sometimes put it.
He expected value stocks to beat growth stocks at one point.
Common call based on the economic environment. Value often does better when interest rates are expected to rise or the economy is perceived as less robust.
Reflects different investment styles performing differently.
Right. Cycles between value and growth.
He highlights a big election win in Japan, enabling reforms, particularly postal reform. Why was that important?
Because the Japanese postal system held massive amounts of savings. Reforming such a huge financial institution could have major economic effects.
A specific global political event with big potential impact.
Shows you need to watch politics everywhere.
And finally, on policy, he tackles the misconception that tax cuts only help the rich.
Using that bar owner analogy, the person paying the most tax gets the biggest absolute dollar cut if rates fall.
Just how progressive tax math works.
Right. But then he also raises the concern about capital flight, rich people, or companies leaving if taxes get too high, mentioning Halliburton moving to Dubai.
So a discussion of both distributional effects and behavioral responses to tax policy.
Exactly. Complex issue with different facets.
Okay, final section. Global investing. He defines globalization, focusing on the economic side.
Setting the scene. How national economies are getting woven together creates opportunities, challenges for investors.
He uses the number of borders in the world as a reminder of divisions.
Yeah, just a quick point about the geopolitical reality. It's still a world of nations, despite globalization. Context.
He points to Japan's Big Bang financial reforms as a turning point.
Specific policy shift credited with helping revive Japan's economy after its long slump shows reform can work.
He called Japan the Seabiscuit of investing one year.
Ah, yeah. Like the underdog racehorse who surprises everyone. Japan exceeded low expectations thanks to banking reform. Engaging analogy.
Makes the point stick. And he listed positive indicators following those reforms in Japan.
Showing the tangible results. Better employment, confidence, spending, reforms leading to real economic improvement.
Financial reform helping the broader economy.
That's the link.
Uses that amazing image of cranes in Shanghai.
Uncountable cranes. a powerful visual symbol of China's insane construction boom back then, prepping for the Olympics and just growing.
A real-world indicator of massive growth.
Hard to argue with that visual. Really captured the scale of China's transformation.
He talked about the rollerblade generation in Asia.
Yeah, young people growing up wealthier, more focused on consuming than saving like their parents. A big cultural and economic shift.
Generational change impacting economic trends.
Huge implications for future demand.
Quick mentions of mandatory voting in Brazil and Brazilians having higher risk tolerance.
Just little cultural or institutional details that differentiate countries and can influence investment climates or behavior.
Adds flavor to the global picture.
Mm-hmm.
He found an economic silver lining in the Asian tsunami.
Grim, but yeah. The massive rebuilding effort boosted demand for commodities, building materials, shows how even tragedies have economic ripple effects.
Unforeseen consequences.
Often the case.
He coined China, technology, telecom, oil, power.
A handy acronym to frame the key investment themes driving China's boom, then? A thematic approach.
Helps investors focus.
Yeah, simplifies a complex market into key drivers.
And he saw huge potential for China's oil demand.
Driven by more cars on the road, people moving to cities, basic development trends leading to massive energy needs.
Demographic shifts driving commodity demand.
Fundamental link there.
His take on Casablanca, Morocco.
Not quite prime investment territory then, based on wealth levels. But he noted their flat tax as a lesson for the U.S., plus some fun history about the movie.
Blend of economics and culture.
Yeah, makes it more engaging.
Canary Islands resembling Monte Carlo. Surprising.
Yeah, challenges preconceptions. Shows how development can transform places unexpectedly. Don't rely on stereotypes.
Portugal compared to California.
Yeah.
And the cork industry.
Geographic similarities, then the economic driver of cork. He found that irony amusing Catholic Portugal supplying sin industries.
Quirky details about specific economies.
Makes the global tour more interesting.
Oman, oil wealth funding infrastructure, notable non-OPEC status, and that history with frankincense.
Connecting current oil wealth back to historical commodity wealth shows how resources shape economies over centuries.
History matters for understanding the present.
Often does.
Egypt, geopolitical importance, Suez Canal, mixed economy, but potential for growth via technology. Like U.S. farming.
Recognizing strategic location and development potential, even amidst challenges like poverty, an optimistic view on adopting technology.
Tunisian nickname Star Wars.
Huh. Yeah, filming location. Seen as a potential bridge between Africa and Europe. Geographic and cultural connections.
Italy. Close election, political divisions, but also that blend of old and new. Pope using tech. And market reforms like the Borsa Italiana IPO.
Captures a snapshot of a European nation in transition, politically and economically.
Japan again.
Yeah.
Urging investors to ditch outdated negative views. Focus on the big JC Japan and China link.
Seeing the booming exports from Japan to China as the big story, even if Wall Street was skeptical. Calling for an updated perspective.
Challenging consensus views.
Good analysis often does.
Sweden. Venice of the North, modern economy beyond farming, mix of welfare and privatization.
Profile of a developed Nordic economy, balancing social systems with modern industry.
Denmark, similar profile, high-tech farming, welfare, stability, privatization.
Another example of that Nordic model adapting.
He makes that great point about fear always being present for investors.
Yeah, comparing modern terror fears to historical Viking fears. There's always a reason not to invest if you look for one. Need that long-term perspective.
Don't let fear paralyze you.
Crucial advice.
From Norway. Rich from resources, high living standards, efficient policy, unique EU relationship.
Example of a resource-rich nation managing its wealth well while carving its own path with Europe.
Scotland. Booming exports beyond whiskey, diversified economy, electronics, energy, finance, tourism.
Challenging the stereotype again. Showing a region's broader economic strength.
Belgium. Strategic location, industrial history, transport hub, very trade-oriented.
Highlighting how geography and history shape a country's economic role. Belgium as a key European trade nexus.
His trip to the European Economic Forum in Poland.
Yeah, firsthand account, discussing regional challenges like Poland's brain drain, but also seeing a different, perhaps more dynamic side of the country.
Personal experience adding depth.
Makes it more real.
Cayman Islands as a major offshore financial center.
Just acknowledging its significant specialized role in the global financial plumbing.
Banking, funds, Ooh, insurance.
For Africa. Complex history, apartheid, but now Africa's biggest economy. Those themes feed the world, ag potential, fuel the world commodities, and the World Cup buildup.
Connecting past struggles to current strengths and future opportunities, using themes to frame the investment case. Kenya. Historical context, Mombasa, Swahili, ag potential, but facing big challenges. Poverty, corruption, security. Needs governance to unlock potential.
Realistic look at a developing nation. Potential is there, but obstacles are significant. Governance is key.
Seychelles. Debt issues hindering short-term investment, but long-term potential via privatization, fishing, farming, strategic location.
Acknowledging short-term problems, but identifying long-term paths to growth for a small island nation.
Oman's history again. Defeating Portugal, naval power, slavery, then frankincense.
More historical context, showing shifts in power and valuable commodities over time.
He uses that fish spending analogy connected to subprime mortgages.
Yeah, a creative way to show how seemingly unrelated parts of the economy and finance can be linked, revealing hidden connections or risks.
Everything's connected somehow.
Often is, yeah.
And finally, Dubai's transformation.
Wow, yeah. From vast place to global hub, diversifying from oil to tourism, services, real estate boom, those mega projects.
Yeah.
Fastest growing city.
Incredible example of rapid development.
Shows what focused investment and vision can achieve.
And he ends with that personal story, the great pretzel thief.
Huh. Yeah, using a relatable, slightly funny travel mishap to illustrate how perceived risks of global investing might be overblown or manageable makes it less intimidating.
Okay, so wrapping up this this deep dive into Froelich's thoughts, what really stands out?
Well, definitely his early sense of those deflationary pressures from globalization. That was quite insightful.
And the constant drumbeat about earnings being fundamental.
Right. Plus those recurring economic cycles, the interconnectedness of global events and policy.
Yeah, and it's kind of striking how many of the themes, inflation worries, Fed policy, global competition, are things we're still grappling with today, maybe just in different forms.
Absolutely. The specifics change, but the underlying dynamics often have echoes.
So the real value here for you listening is using these past perspectives to maybe see today's world a bit more clearly.
Exactly. Think about that theme of adaptation and change. How does looking back help you understand what's happening now?
And maybe think about the next big shifts.
Yeah. What are the potential icebergs on our horizon now? Things like AI, climate change impacts, massive geopolitical realignments. What are those huge, slow-moving forces that are maybe just starting to come into view, but will likely shape markets and economies for decades? Something for you to think about.